Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is Christopher Roberts against FHFA. Mr. Thompson.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, David Thompson for the plaintiff appellants. The network sweep is unlawful and must be enjoined for two independent reasons. First, the transaction violated Harrah's clear prohibition on Treasury increasing its ownership stake in the companies after 2009. And second, FHFA, by imposing a mandatory zero capital regime, violated its own statutory commands to preserve and conserve assets and restore them to soundness. Now, with respect to Treasury, Harrah gave Treasury temporary authority to purchase the company's stock, and that authority expired in 2009.
Why did it purchase the stock? It changed the way it was going to get dividends.
Well, if we look at the economics of it, Your Honor, it is no different than if they purchased every single outstanding share of common stock and junior preferred stock, in the sense of after the sweep, they now get all the economic benefits that would have flowed to the junior preferred shareholders.
Have you made a takings claim in the Court of Federal Claims?
Yes, Your Honor, we have.
Why isn't that the right remedy?
Well,
your description of this is essentially that the value of the stock has been confiscated by a dividends rule passing all the money to the Treasury. Well, if that's true, that sounds like a takings claim. Why are we having this fight in the Seventh Circuit?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect, our position is that under the APA, that if the court finds that it was unlawful, that it shall be set aside. And in Levin versus Miller, the court declined the government's invitation to interpret a statute to impose a massive takings liability on the United States government. And to answer the court's question about was this really a purchase or not, if we look at the government's own conduct, Your Honor, in this very case, under 1719G1B, the government has to make certain findings whenever they do a purchase. And they did those findings in the First Amendment and in the other amendments, even though in that instance too, there wasn't a single additional share. Rather, there was new economic value being created. And if we look at their revenue ruling, and we cite this in our case, it's revenue ruling 56-564. That revenue ruling involves a situation not unlike this, where you had preferred stock and then it changes. The liquidation preference of the preferred stock is increased to equal the entire net worth of the companies. And the Treasury Department itself said, that's an exchange. That's a new security.
Well, it's interesting you're talking about the liquidation preference, because actually even the First and the Second Amendments had an effect on Treasury's liquidation preference. You know, you're complaining that they were paying dividends and that they weren't using the other option, which would increase the liquidation preference. But I don't see why, if you think this is essentially a nationalization of Fannie and Freddie, why the nationalization didn't happen sooner.
Okay, so a couple of points. Number one, with respect to Treasury's authority, the First and Second Amendment were before the sunset. They raced to do the Second Amendment on December 24th, 2009, because they understood that the authority was going away.
But they were still talking about the dividends that they were going to get. And what was happening, of course, was these 10% things, is Fannie and Freddie at that point didn't have enough money to pay it, so they kept borrowing more, and there was a big spiral of debt that was going on.
Okay, so I think we're talking about two separate things, Your Honor, because with respect to Treasury's authority, which is what I had been focusing on, there's a clear temporal divide. The court is asking about FHFA and its conduct and this whole notion of a death spiral. And with respect, number one, the complaint is crystal clear in this case that there was never a threat of insolvency, and that because there was a payment in kind.
Why is that the kind of fact that, if alleged in the complaint, the court has to accept? I realize, you know, that if a complaint alleges, you know, that the light was green, you have to assume the light was green. But I don't understand why something along those lines is is simply to be accepted.
Well, and I understand the difference between adjudicative facts and legislative facts in the Moore versus Madigan case, Your Honor, but this is plainly an adjudicative fact. The question is whether these particular companies had sufficient earnings and ability to actually pay the dividends, and whether, in fact, in the real world, there was a problem with circular draws, or whether it is a pretext, as we maintain. We say it is a pretext for two reasons. Number one, under the PSPAs, there was an absolute right to elect to not pay the dividends. And so there was never a threat of insolvency.
Well, but increasing the liquidation preference, certainly, in the end, is a claim on the assets.
But their argument about the death spiral and the circular draws is that it imperiled the line of commitment. Their argument is, we were doing these draws, we did $26 billion worth of them, and that was a big problem because it imperiled the line of commitment.
So where are you getting the 26 from? I remember that there was first a cap of $100 billion, and then it got popped up to $200 billion, and then the cap was taken off altogether. And I guess one of the fundamental problems, I certainly share Judge Easterbrook's opening question. If this is really just nationalizing Fannie and Freddie, and your clients haven't been compensated, there's a forum for those kinds of claims. But putting that to one side, I was overwhelmed reading these briefs with the sense that you are taking an ex post viewpoint on this, and at the time all of these arrangements were made, it was not at all clear whether the dividend that was due was going to be payable. What you call the net worth sweep turned out to be favorable in some years, not favorable in other years. Nobody knew. People were making arrangements.
Your Honor, with respect, our complaint is replete with sworn deposition testimony, with internal emails from the government showing that they in fact knew. They did a renewed push on August 8th of 2012, the CFO of Fannie Mae went in to meet with senior Treasury officials, and they asked, that deferred tax asset, are you thinking of reversing it? And she testified that she told them, yes, we are. They said, when? She said, 2013 in all likelihood. They said, how much money will that be? She said, about $50 billion. That's ex ante. And we have an email from that morning where the participants in that meeting said, let's have a renewed push to get this done. So that's ex ante. It's also ex ante the fact that they could just do a payment in kind and increase the liquidation preference. The court asked, where do I get the $26 billion from? What I'm talking about there is the amount of circular draws. The court is correct that the line of commitment started at $100 billion and then went up to $200 billion. But when they invoke the line
Counsel,
of commitment...
where else are similar claims pending? The D.C. Circuit's decided one such claim.
Yes.
Where else are they being litigated?
I believe there are cases in the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit has had oral argument. The Fifth and the Eighth have not.
And when was the oral argument in the Sixth Circuit?
Approximately July 29th.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
What I was thinking about, just to pursue this point for a minute, I'm looking at the Treasury's brief. For the Third Amendment, they note that by exchanging a fixed dividend for a variable one, they accept more risk. And so there's some years, of course, 2013 and 2014, where they get more than they thought, but they say they received less in dividends in 2015 and 2016 than they would have under the original 10% number. So that it's numbers like that that made me think, okay, well, if you're going to focus only on the years in which it was in one direction, that's doesn't seem right to me.
Well, Your Honor, two things. On a net basis, if you look at the totality of all the years, it's $130 billion. But the other point, and this is crucial,
because each year is different.
Your Honor, every year is the same in this respect. It was impossible for them to make less money under the Third Amendment. Impossible. Because in the regime prior to, and let me explain why. If I may, in the regime prior under the Second Amendment, let's say the company's made $5 billion in profits. Treasury would take all of the $5 billion. It's true.
Can I ask you about what's a profit, by the way? It seems to me it's at the end of each quarter, correct, that these that the net that what you call the net worth sweeps happen?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so during the course of that quarter, Fannie and Freddie are operating, I assume, as businesses. They're paying money out, they're getting money in, they're operating ordinarily, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so why couldn't, during the course of a quarter, they pay down the liquidation preference, for example?
They're not permitted to under the PSPAs without Treasury's authority. That's why we call this a concrete life preserver. This so-called bailout is unlike any other that I've ever seen in that the companies are...
What provision of the PSPA prohibits that?
Your Honor, I can get you that particular site on rebuttal, but they are not, I believe all the parties agree, that they are not allowed to pay down the liquidation preference without the approval of Treasury. And going back to this idea of, well, the Treasury accepted some risk, what they say, that's not true. And I want to just follow through on that logic. So if in 2000, under the Second Amendment, let's say in 2011, the companies made $5 billion, Treasury would take all of that $5 billion.
Right. Now, I understand.
It's true there would be a circular draw, and on a net basis, you know, they pay themselves some dividends and borrow, but on a net basis, they get $5 billion. Now, under the Third Amendment, if the companies make $5 billion, they still get it. The difference, the only economic difference, is that under the Third Amendment, if the companies make more than $19 billion, they get to keep it. And we have their internal documents, which we cite in the complaint, where they were celebrating this and talking about
That makes motive the driving force, and I'm not sure motive makes any difference. We have the question here, as I see it, looking, for example, at... what's the section? 4617F. We have the question whether Treasury has acted in an ultra vires manner, whether it has in fact operated under the powers it's given, either as conservator or receiver, or whether it's outside those powers. Otherwise, there's no jurisdiction for us to do anything. Or no, I don't want to say jurisdiction. There's no the statute doesn't create a claim.
So Your Honor, Judge Brown on the D.C. Circuit agreed...
She was the dissenting judge, right?
No, but she agreed with the point that motive is irrelevant, and she still found that FHFA...
But had, you were just making a motive argument. If we could delete that and just say both sides agree motive makes no difference, I'd be perfectly happy.
We agree that if the court only looks at effect, we win, and the reason is because the effect of what they have done is imposed a mandatory zero capital regime. Director Watt himself has testified that it is especially irresponsible to run these two huge financial institutions with zero capital soundness. 46.
But what about the zero? That's why I asked about actual operations. If this operates on the net amount of money at the end of each quarter, after these organizations have conducted their business in the ordinary course of business, why does it hurt them to have, why does it impede their ability to do business if the amount of money at the end of the quarter is greater or lesser?
Director Watt testified that every business needs to have capital for the vicissitudes of the business cycle, that you have that, and that's why throughout financial institutions...
How were Fannie and Freddie hurt by this system, other than by not paying dividends to your clients, which is not an injury to them, it's an injury to your clients?
They were hurt by having zero capital. It is mandated.
Why? You're saying that, but I don't understand why.
I'm not saying it. Congress is saying it. Congress says soundness. It has to be operated in a sound manner. And 4513 of this statute makes clear that soundness means having capital. And we see that
But Treasury is standing behind them.
If the argument is that the line of commitment is the capital, number one, Director Watt has said it's not operating capital. Number two, the PSPAs do not treat that line of commitment as capital. And number three, the net worth sweep
exposes that line of commitment to maximum vulnerability. In the absence of the sweep, there would be $130 billion of capital standing between losses and having to draw on the line of commitment. Now, because all of that profit is off the balance sheet and they're operating in a zero capital world, the first dollar of loss comes out of the line of commitment. In the absence of the sweep, there'd be $130 billion on the balance sheet to absorb those losses. And so when Congress said that that the FHFA has to operate it in a sound and solvent manner, it was referencing capital. We see that in the regulations. We see that in HERA itself. 4513 says soundness means maintaining proper capital. With respect, I'd like to go back to this argument.
Maybe you could talk for a minute about why your clients have a right to bring this as a direct action.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, under the APA...
Because it sounds to me from everything you've said so far is that you are making an argument that Fannie and Freddie have been hurt, not your clients.
Both have been hurt, Your Honor. But we have been... Fannie
only,
and
only derivatively, though.
No. Okay. Fannie and Freddie were hurt because they don't have capital. We were hurt because all of the economic value associated with our shares were taken away, and it doesn't affect all shareholders equally. One shareholder, the United States Treasury, is benefiting and was able to take all of these shares away. And under the APA, it's a lenient standard, and zone of interest has been met. I see my time is on. I'd like to save my time for rebuttal, if I may.
That would be fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Kane?
May it please the Court, Your Honor. Actually, it's Jerry Sinzdak appearing on behalf of the Treasury Department.
I'm
sharing
Mr.
time
Sinzdak.
With Mr.
All right, that's fine.
Mr. Kane. Your Honor, two separate and independent provisions of HERA bar plaintiffs' claims. First, HERA's anti-injunction provision, 4617F, which prohibits a court from taking any action that would restrain or affect FHFA's powers as conservator, applies here. The Third Amendment was a quintessential, as the D.C. Circuit put it, a quintessential conservator task. It involved renegotiations of dividends with the GSE's most significant and vital investor, the Treasury Department. And for that reason, 4617F applies. Alternatively,
so isn't this one of those situations, though, where in order to decide whether we can decide, as I said, I think probably more whether this states a claim, but to the extent it matters, we do need to see whether what Treasury did was within the scope of the powers or functions that it has under the statute as conservator. It's not a receiver in this instance, right? It's a conservator?
It's a conservator.
All right, fine. So through the back door, that comes pretty close to having to decide the whole merits of the case, just to decide whether we can decide the case, right?
Your Honor, the question whether it acted beyond the scope of its conservator powers is
right.
Effectively
that's the whole
the same
game.
As an APA claim
right.
That it acted
that's
beyond
the whole game. And... So your opponents argue, how can you say it's conserving these two companies to have their full net worth be the amount of the dividends that are owed as opposed to some other number, some other system?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And I think there's a point that's very important that Your Honor has already alluded to. And I want to make this clear up front. Between 2008 and 2012, Treasury committed $445 billion to the GSEs. That is to cover any time their net worth falls below zero, thus ensuring they never become insolvent. The GSEs have drawn $190 billion from that commitment, roughly, between 2008 and 2012, but that has left $258 billion in taxpayer funds that are there and available to the GSEs any time that their net worth falls below zero. And that commitment is absolutely vital to the GSEs. It is that commitment that has kept them in business for the last 5.5 years since the Third Amendment. It is that commitment that gives the market confidence that they will remain in business. It is that commitment that has, that assures that they will be around for the foreseeable future.
So let me put it this way. Your opponent has, at a minimum, suggested an alternative way that the markets could have had confidence post-2012, and that's by letting them keep their own or decide. I'm not sure they would have kept every penny. They would have paid something out in dividends to all of their stockholders. But, you know, he was throwing around, you know, $126 billion is a number, some other number, call it $100 billion if you want. That would be another way to have confidence in the companies. And I guess the question is that, are you forced to do it that way? Or are you allowed to do it with putting the credit of the United States behind them?
Well, precisely, Your Honor. I mean, it's, you know, fundamentally at root, plaintiff's claims are this could have been done a different way. But that goes to the business judgment of FHFA. Surely it's up to FHFA to decide whether it would prefer to, you know, build up internal capital or rely on Treasury's capital to keep the businesses ongoing. That is fundamentally a business judgment. And, of course, plaintiffs disagree strongly with it, and they think it could have been done a different way, as Your Honor points out. But that is fundamentally a business decision by FHFA as conservator in the position of how to ensure that these systemically important entities remain in operation for the foreseeable future. And that is protected by 4617F. That is precisely the type of business judgment that is protected by the anti-injunction provision.
Now, when you mentioned business judgment, it makes me think of the business judgment rule and things like that. Right. Are we dealing here in a realm entirely of federal law, or does I realize that the companies for internal affairs have chosen the laws in their bylaws of various of Delaware and Virginia, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. But it is, you know, at root, HERA is, of course, a federal statute, and mm-hmm. federal law applies. Obviously, as we point out in our brief, particularly with respect to the direct derivative claim issue, federal law often looks to state law on those issues. But I think, at least on those issues, the state and federal law is in accord with what qualifies as a direct claim versus a derivative claim. And as Your Honor suggested earlier, these are quintessentially derivative claims. They allege a harm to the company, and they seek a relief, the unwinding of the Third Amendment that would flow to the companies, not directly to the shareholders. And therefore, these are, again, classic derivative claims, and so alternatively barred by the transfer of shareholder rights provision.
Is there anything can you give me an example of something that would have been beyond the power of FHFA to take that would not be immune under 4614F?
Sure, Your Honor. I think one example that has arisen in other litigation is the suggestion that the conservator is regulating the entities. FHFA also serves as a regulator and is subject to, in most cases, with some exceptions, APA review of their actions as a regulator. So in cases like Leon County and Sonoma County, that was from the Ninth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit, there was the allegation that you're acting as a regulator, you can't do that. And the courts rejected that argument, but that would be an example of where...
acting as a regular.
Of where they'd
well, that
acting.
Takes us to the FDIC analogies, doesn't it?
Yes, and we believe the case law is analogous under FURIA.
Okay, I guess the last question is maybe a version of the first question. If, in fact, the Treasury has made itself the owner of every last penny of net worth, why wasn't this a purchase of the stock at a time after that power had expired?
Yes, Your Honor, and with respect, just for one second, of course, our argument is that 4617F bars even that claim against Treasury because an injunction would restrain FHFA as directly as it would. But to answer Your Honor's question, it's not a purchase primarily because Treasury invested no new taxpayer dollars and acquired no new shares. And I think it is on that front important, again, to remember the purpose or the intent behind the purchase provision in the first place. That was to allow Treasury to provide taxpayer dollars to prop up the GSEs in 2008 when they were in a precarious financial situation. And then obviously Congress, I think as the surrounding provisions indicate, was concerned about protecting taxpayer dollars and ensuring.
Sure.
So it placed a temporal limit on how long Treasury could do that. And here we have an example where Treasury, you know, did not commit any additional funds. And this was simply a contract amendment and a modification to the underlying fixed dividend obligation to change it to a variable one. And that's all we have here, Your Honor.
Okay.
If Your Honors have no further questions.
No, fine. Thank you. All right, now it's your turn, Mr. Kane. Sorry.
May it please the Court, Howard Kane for Federal Housing Finance Agency. Judge Easterbrook asked a question which I believe gets at the heart of what's going on. Plaintiffs are not happy with the original contract from 2008. They don't like the structure that was set up then. They don't like the fact that pursuant to authority granted to Treasury expressly in the 2008 HERA legislation, and I note that that authority is included in the statutory charters of Fannie and Freddie themselves, a very unique situation. The director in 2008 set up a new paradigm and it determined that it would not evaluate capital the way capital is typically evaluated, the capital in the bank. Instead, as has been indicated, the director looked at how large is the Treasury commitment. Is that a large enough to satisfy the purposes of capital? Is it large enough to keep the markets happy? And over time, that was increased. But the important point was, from day one, in 2008, way beyond the statute of limitations, Your Honors, as I pointed out in both briefs, from day one, it was not set up that the conservatorship, that capital would be maintained at some type of regulatory minimum. And it was set up that way because the purpose of the commitment was to assure that no, at no time were the institutions, would FHFA be required to place them into mandatory receivership and close them down. Because again, as the court knows, these aren't just plain vanilla national banks or state chartered banks. These are financial institutions, but Congress chartered them as part of a greater purpose. That greater purpose was to facilitate, to enable, to enhance the operation of the national mortgage markets. And that was that was the key purpose of these enterprises. So when this capital, when Treasury made this massive investment, and I emphasize, it's only by the grace of the continuation of this massive investment today, over $250 billion, that these enterprises remain operational. The relief sought by plaintiffs would set aside, just wreak havoc on this, I would say, magnificent oversight effort to assure the operation of these enterprises.
Apparently, you think very poorly of bankruptcy judges.
I do not.
Lots of businesses that go underwater continue in operation. If they have value in their future operations, they are recapitalized and continue. Your assertions just deny that that process exists. I don't think you need to make assertions like that in order to prevail in this case. But if your argument depends on them, you've got a large world of experience in finance against you.
Your Honor, I respect that. I don't disagree with the court's comments. My point was only, and if I overstated it, apologies, my point only was the...
Your point was that when a business fails, only nationalization will save it. And that isn't true.
No, the statute...
You don't want to rest on this argument.
You were starting to say that there is particular legislation that Congress passed in this particular area to create a different solution that Congress, for reasons best known to itself, didn't want, at least in 2008, the bankruptcy process to unfold. It could change its mind at any time, I presume. One of the things that I pondered looking at all of this is it entirely up to Treasury or FHFA or somebody else to put an end to this system in which we have the net worth at the end of each quarter being paid over to Treasury? I mean, are we just doing this forever, or is this a temporary expedient?
In the pertinent provisions of the agreement, Your Honor, as amended, it provides that, for example, the periodic commitment fee will be relinquished, will not be required for so long as the new dividend structure remains in place. So it in that language, I believe it contemplates the possibility of further amendments tomorrow or down the road, but...
That might restore this to some semblance of a market kind of operation? Or?
Your Honor, restore it to market operation. A decision could be made to place in receivership. Congress might take action that would get implemented by the structure, but the conservatorship itself is, by definition, temporary but indefinite. I could not...
Okay.
That sounds very much like a government agency.
A temporary but indefinite structure. And I
Which,
guess...
for a government agency, lasts 100 years? How much longer?
Temporarily.
Yeah. Temporarily, that's right.
The Interstate Commerce Commission lasted 100.
As they said in one of my favorite movies.
The Interstate Commerce Commission did last 100 before it was replaced by another identical agency with a different
Surface
name.
Surface Transportation Board.
Yeah.
Right. So, yes, yeah, so we have this temporary permanent or permanent temporary situation. And all I was going to do was ask what you think the term conservatorship means. Your opponents have said that means you've got to sort of give the companies the best boost possible. In what sense do you think you're running a conservatorship?
Well, the reference to solvency, I believe, Your Honor, means that it stays technically solvent over zero so that it not be placed into receivership under the mandatory statute.
Under the particular statute that governs this area.
Yes,
right.
But beyond that, I believe conservatorship in the context that Congress set up this gave this power is to assure or enable the operation of these enterprises until such time as a receivership is imposed or until the conservatorship ends. For the temporary period of the conservatorship, the whole point of being the purpose of existence for the conservator is to facilitate, to enable these enterprises to operate, notwithstanding the fact that without the Treasury, in this case, support, they would be unable to operate at all.
So they've been conserved in the sense that they're put in a position to continue doing business in the market of the sort that Congress wants them to do, to keep the national mortgage markets liquid and operating.
I would agree with that precise statement. Your Honor. And if I can... Oh.
No, you're not out yet.
I would also highlight that a lot of your courts back and forth with plaintiff counsel and talking about motive and purpose. At the end of the day, this case is, I believe, effectively controlled by Your Honor's decision, and Judge Bauer was on the panel in Courtney v. Halloran, which dealt with the FDIC analog to the statute here. The lower court, in this case, relied heavily on that decision. And that makes it clear that motive, purpose, intent, none of that is relevant. The only issue for the lower court, and I respectfully submit this court, is did the FHFA exercise a power authorized by Congress in this case? It did. It was operating the institutions. It was conducting the business of the enterprises.
The take over the assets of and operate the regulated entity with all the powers, et cetera, right? That's what you're relying on?
Right. And as long as the FHFA is exercising a power granted by Congress, which it was, we submit that is the end of the inquiry. That's what this court found in the FDIC analog. And that same analysis applies precisely
here.
You
say that takes us over into 4617F.
Yes, the statute the court relied on in the Halloran case was 1821J.
It was an analogous statute.
Yes, the actual words, except for FDIC and FHFA, were precisely identical, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If there are no further questions.
I see none, so thank you very much. Mr. Thompson, I'm sure you have something further, so... We're glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So just quickly on Treasury made the point during its presentation that 4617F
bars any injunction against Treasury, even though, of course, it only talks about FHFA. With all respect to Treasury, we would say that is both wrong and irrelevant. It's wrong because Congress was very clear that it wanted the courts to enjoin violations of HERA. Even FHFA, which is the beneficiary of the anti-injunction provision, admits that it can be enjoined if it violates HERA. So there's no reason to think that Treasury would somehow be in a better position, even though they didn't get an anti-injunction provision. But as
none of them think they've violated HERA, of course, because the general powers of the agency as conservator or receiver, 4617B, are quite broad.
But Your Honor, their position is that tomorrow Treasury could walk into FHFA and say, we'd like to buy 1,000 shares of Fannie.
That would be a new case that is not before
But
us.
That's their position. That is their position. And Your Honor, Judge Chang cut right through that and said, it's irrelevant. Because he said, what is alleged here is that Treasury and FHFA entered into an agreement to violate HERA by purchasing shares out of time. That's our position. But when
the agency as conservator takes over the assets, collects money, performs functions, and whatever, why does that mean the agency is forbidden from talking to its counterparty? I mean, you seem to think agreement makes it bad.
No, an agreement to purchase out of time is what makes it
bad.
But
that's not what we have here.
Well, under their revenue ruling, 56-564, the Treasury Department tells taxpayers in a transaction just like this one, that's a sale.
But
that's an exchange.
But you had that whole section of your brief with quite a few analogies, but this statute needs to be read for itself, right?
Well, I don't think they have
not
pointed to
revenue rulings are the best evidence here.
And their regulations and securities law. They have not pointed to any body of law which exalts form over substance like this. And here's the point I was trying to make, Your Honor, which is under HERA, when there is a purchase, certain determinations need to be made. This is under 1719 G1B. They have to, if there's a purchase, Treasury needs to make a determination.
No, you made that point earlier.
And earlier, there were no shares that were added, and they made that determination. We see that on page 89 of the appendix. And so Treasury's own conduct here conforms to economic reality up until the time of the sweep. They recognize.
But how could they operate as a conservator? In your view, anything they do as a conservator makes them de facto a purchaser, which I think is inconsistent with the language of the statute.
Any time Treasury, after December 31, 2009, increases its equity ownership stake in
But it didn't do that. What it did was it took all the benefit from the shares.
Wow.
I mean, suppose it had just said, you used to owe us, a certain amount of money each quarter. Now we're going to double it. Would that be subject to your same arguments?
That might be problematic. We'd have to look at the effect of it, but it would be different from FHFA's perspective in one key respect, is it would not be a zero capital regime. It would be a problem for Treasury. Treasury's increasing its economic stake in the companies. Congress was very clear that they wanted a temporal limit on the ability of the United States government to buy more equity, to increase their equity stake in these companies.
No, you've made that point repeatedly, and I guess the whole question is that a fair characterization, or in fact, is the alternative characterization that they're offering a better match for the various powers they have as conservator? As conservators, they can carry on the business. They can do all sorts of things. I don't know that that has anything to do with how many shares they have.
So FHFA has authority to carry on the business. Treasury doesn't have any authority to carry on the business. They
buy
Treasury
shares. has underwritten the business.
Yes, and they could do that underwriting up until they could increase their equity stake up until the sunset. If I may, in my remaining moment, FHFA said solvency. They said nothing about soundness on solvency. They told the Southern District of Florida the companies are effectively insolvent, and they should be held to making that statement. Judge Brown, in her dissent, quotes it.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. Take the case under advisement.